Well, I'm at a certain age where I've been through disappointments, and I've had my identity stripped away, and by losing a job on this or something ending, and it's like, well, that's no longer what I do, and those things aren't permanent. Things that you've accomplished and even awards and stuff, that does stick with you, but it's not that important to who you are as a person. It's not at all important to who you are as a person.
That was award-winning editor Mark Kiefer, whose extensive career spans nearly three decades, with credits at Disney, Netflix, and Warner Brothers, just to name a small few. With a wide variety of experience across picture, sound, animation, and even music. A few months ago, Mark's seemingly innocuous LinkedIn post caught the attention of tens of thousands across the industry. And that post was nothing more than a selfie of Mark in a Trader Joe's uniform, sharing that after decades in Hollywood, he had taken his first non-creative job so that he could support his family. In today's episode, Mark and I have a candid conversation about what it means to stay resilient, creative, and most importantly, humble when your identity as a creative no longer pays your bills. We talk about the transformative advice that his dad gave him as a teenager, his wide and varied career as a generalist, and how he's made multiple career pivots, and how letting go of your professional identity can bring new opportunities, new relationships, and even new paths to creativity. Whether you're just in between gigs, you're really struggling to pay the bills right now, or if you're at the point where you feel you've lost your entire identity along the way, Mark's willingness to honestly and vulnerably share his story is a powerful reminder that you are not alone, and that your worth is never defined by the job title on your resume. If we haven't met before, hey, I'm Zach, and welcome to my existential crisis. I have spent my entire career making a living as a creative, and like you, I'm wondering what the future holds for all of us. I may not have all the answers, but few are more dedicated to helping you find them than I am. Come join me as I have candid conversations with some of the world's most interesting people to explore what truly matters in life while making sense of our messy creative minds along the way. No matter the challenges you might be navigating, you always have a safe space here with me. Okay, now before we get to today's interview, I've got one quick bit of housekeeping, but I promise this is only going to take a sec. If you haven't already registered for my upcoming 5-day virtual summit that's all about navigating the future of entertainment, now is the time, because come Monday, June 23rd, I am about to release some of the most amazing conversations that I've had with some of the most brilliant minds in my 10 years of podcasting. I organized 15 different guest interviews for this 5-day virtual summit for us, the creatives, the artists, the creators, and the storytellers. So we have the strategies, the tools, and most importantly, so we have the community to navigate the next act of our creative careers together, regardless of all of the fear and uncertainty that's getting in our way. To learn more and get your free ticket before we launch June 23rd, and yes, I said free, visit zacharnold.com/summit2025. That's zacharnold.com, zacharnold.com/summit2025, zacharnold.com/summit2025. And now on to today's show. So Mark, first of all, I have to say that it is a tremendous pleasure to have you with me today, and I very much appreciate you taking the time. And just wanted to share how, as we talked a little bit about off the record, I can't fathom how you and I over the last 20 plus years have not connected at some point, because we live and work in such a tiny, tiny, tiny little corner of a tiny little industry that when and we're going to talk more about this in a second, where I saw this post that you put on LinkedIn and apparently just went, I want to say viral, like Mr. Beast viral, but basically went industry viral with hundreds, if not thousands, of comments. And essentially the post went as follows. Not the whole post, but I'll summarize the beginning of it. I'm a film editor. Well, at least that's what it says on my resume. My IMDb page has lots of evidence to prove it as well, along with some other sound credits and minor accolades, which, by the way, not true. Major accolades, which we'll get into. The attached selfie is of me right before walking into work at Trader Joe's for my first shift on December 9th, 2024. So why post this photo? And that, my friend, is why I wanted to have you on the show today. So first of all, thank you so much for being here today to share the little bit deeper version of your story that you could do on your LinkedIn post. And then secondly, why post the photo?
Well, thanks for having me, Zach. It's exciting to be here with you. And I am surprised that we haven't met before. But yeah, we can maybe sleuth that out later and figure out why. Okay. Maybe we can get into some of the background later, but I basically, in 30 years of being in the film industry, of just working, even side gigs, but like usually when you're in a creative industry, your side gigs are creative gigs. I was a sound editor for a long time, sound designer, and then I was became a film editor. I just kind of switched over. Interesting story behind that as well. But I would always do little side work here and there, but they were always like a little show here or a little thing here, or, you know, being a professional drummer for almost my whole life. A lot of my side gigs were music. And so it was the first time that I had to take something that wasn't a creative role. And it was unnerving a little bit at first. I saw the holidays coming up. I knew that, you know how it is in the industry. Nobody's going to start something new between Thanksgiving and the first half of January. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it's rare. So I was just coming off a show, and I just knew I had to have something, just something to make some ends meet. And the whole time through the interview process at Trader Joe's, through, you know, like there was a couple of weeks, I got the job a couple of weeks before I was finished with this project. And then I was going to start. And that whole time I was like, maybe something will come in, maybe something will come in. And then here comes my first day. And I'm like, I keep thinking, you know, in the back of my head, something's going to come off from the side and save me from having to walk in the store the first time. And just some stroke of, you know, maybe I'll want to talk about this later. I turned around from my truck and I took a picture of me in front of the store. And I never expected to do a big post about it, because at that time I wanted it to be a secret. I wanted it to be something that nobody in my industry knew about. It was just between me and the Trader Joe's crew and my family. And I just really thought that it was going to stay that way. And I thought it was going to be really short-lived. So when I started working there and started seeing that I was not special, I was just like everybody else there, and they were just like me. Not everybody, but a lot of them had been creative film industry people. And we talked about their story, and I got to know them, and I started realizing how incredibly talented they were and skilled and just in more ways than stocking shelves. It's not just about that for them. They work hard, man. I was really impressed by how hard they work there. It's like in the post, I say it's like an 8-hour workout, and it is. You leave spent.
There was a key piece of your post, though, not to interrupt, but I was going to dig into this a little bit later, but you said it's a good tired. And I know what that good tired feels like, but what did that mean to you when you said it's a long day, it's like an 8-hour gym workout, but it's a good tired? That's different than I think a lot of the tired we feel from this industry. That's a bad tired. That's I got hit by a Mack truck today tired.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
It was, I don't know. There's just a satisfaction that you leave with, that you did everything you needed to do to take care of people coming through there, trying to get groceries for their family, making the store look good, cleaning it. And to me, part of my mission there has been to make the people I'm working with feel valuable and valued. And so I've kind of like took it upon myself to get to know everybody that I work with as much as possible. I mean, you're busy, so you can't do too much, but just ask questions about them and get to know them and encourage them. That's all I'm trying to do. And so when you leave at night and it's a good tired, that's what I mean. It's just like, okay, that was a good shift, and you feel like you accomplished something, even though it's like starts over the next day and you know, that shelf is empty, you know, so it just, it's one of those processes that is so cyclical that it will never end as long as the store remains open. So, I guess that's what I meant by that.
I do. I love the way that you framed that, because I think mindset is so important, especially with everything that we're going through in this industry, in this world. There are just so many things that are uncertain. And you very easily could have gone in with the mindset of, this is bullshit. I am too good to be freaking working at Trader Joe's. Why am I checking out groceries? I have won 5 Emmys. I have won multiple Golden Reel Awards. Oh, by the way, I just edited a huge tentpole animated feature. Screw looking for the baked beans on aisle 4, right? But you didn't go in with that mindset, and you could have. How were you able to go into Trader Joe's in such a dire moment right before the holidays? It had been months since you heard about anything. Where did that mindset come from?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not going to lie and say that some of those thoughts haven't ever crossed my mind while being there. I mean, there's some times where it's a hard day and you're wishing your time there was over and you're ready to go. And it's like, okay, this is not where I want to be. And so, yeah, I'm not going to say that never occurs to me, but I guess to answer your question, I didn't think that everybody at Trader Joe's, they don't know who I am. They don't know what my background is. It's not incumbent on them to find everything out about me and be impressed by anything. And so I went in there anonymous, and partly because I thought here it is 6 months and I'm still working there 1 or 2 days a week, but I just didn't think it was worth going in with any attitude. And I guess maybe that's how I take every new job, but I want to do it. It's why not start fresh? Why not have a clean slate with these people and come in and be positive and be a strength to them in the plus and minus columns, be a plus, you know?
Mm-hmm. And kind of goes back to what you were saying about how it wasn't just checking out people for their groceries, stocking the shelves. You saw purpose in the work that you were doing. It was about helping families get their groceries. It was about helping facilitate the work with the team. Mm-hmm. You found purpose in that. And I think that's where so many people feel lost right now, is their identity and their purpose were this job title. I am a feature animation editor. I am a sound editor. Not only that, I'm a 5-time Emmy-winning and Golden Reel Award-winning editor. Those aren't just things that are on a resume. They become our identities. And to walk into Trader Joe's with a name tag and all it has on there is Mark, right? It diminishes decades worth of accomplishments.
Well, I'm at a certain age where I've been through disappointments and I've had my identity stripped away and by losing a job on this or something ending. And it's like, well, that's no longer what I do. And those things aren't permanent. Things that you've accomplished and even awards and stuff that does stick with you, but it's not that important to who you are as a person. It's not at all important to who you are as a person.
Well, speaking of who you are as a person, the instigator for me saying I would like to have Mark on the podcast was, of course, the LinkedIn post with a picture of you at Trader Joe's. I said, I bet there's a story here. What I didn't expect is that I think there is an equally or even more interesting story that has nothing to do with Trader Joe's, because once I started to do a little bit of research, I said, this guy is perfect for the podcast, having nothing to do with the job at Trader Joe's. Hmm. So the two areas that I really want to dig into throughout today's conversation, and I might veer in any other direction that we so choose. Like I told you, as a musician, this is going to be jazz. P.S. I'm a horrible musician and I know nothing about jazz. Conversationally, I'm pretty good at jazz. So having said that, the two things that fascinated me the most are, number one, and I say this in the best way possible, your resume makes absolutely no sense. You have done so many different things and you kind of yada yada the best part where you said, well, I transitioned from sound to editing. What? So that you've done so many different things that most would say they're completely separate career paths. But the second area, and these two will probably be intertwined, is that a very common recurring theme of my conversations on this show is about not just creativity, but about being a creative. And in digging through, I know you don't blog anymore, but you have an extensive blog that you had in the early 2000s. I would argue you're not just a creative person. You define yourself as a creative, and it seems like you need some outlet to be creating things, even if it's a 2-minute video about what the hell is on the hill in our backyard. Like, there's just so many cool experiments, things you've written about, sharing your personal stories. So I'd like to talk a little bit more going backwards now to your career paths, because it really makes no sense. And again, I know what it takes to create such a diverse career path or paths. So I want to dig into all these different angles you've gone. And then I want to talk about what it feels like and what your process is, just knowing when I wake up in the morning, I got to make stuff. So let's just kind of start with the origin story to weave all of these various different story points together as far as the resume and the career paths that you've taken.
Okay. Well, I became a drummer in junior high school, and I just pursued music. I fell in love with drums. And I thought that was just going to be it. I'll just be a drummer, you know. And when I was in high school, my dad, he said, you need to know more than one instrument. I'm like, why? You know, just, and he's not a musician, but something in him knew that it would help him if he knows more than one instrument. So he said, come on, it's your birthday. We're going to go get you a guitar. And so we went to a pawn shop and found a nice Yamaha acoustic guitar. And I started learning guitar as well. And I was like, okay, so drums will always be number one for me, but I'm starting to love guitar. And so that kind of like opened up a horizon for me and my world a little bit in music, thinking there's more to it than just hitting things with sticks. And so at the end of high school, I decided I'm going to study music. And so I was lucky enough to be located. I was in Dallas, Texas. I was close enough to North Texas, University of North Texas, and which is a world-renowned music school. And I thought, well, that's what I'm going to do, you know? And so I did the long track there. I studied jazz, and then I changed my major to, you know, this and that. Ended up with a music education degree, and which means, you know, when you have one of those, that means you had to learn all of the band instruments. You had to go through all the whole thing, and like, you know, the woodwinds and the brass and the string instruments and everything, and not be proficient, but just know how they're played, and so that you can teach others. And so that was my thing, and I thought, well, I'm going to teach, and I ended up not teaching because I started playing in bands, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to teach. You know, I did teach privately for about 9 years, but I didn't teach in a school setting. But I kept playing, and I opened up a recording studio, and I'm kind of rushing through all this, but it's basically, it just one thing led to another. I opened up this recording studio behind our house. I started doing records for people, and, you know, everywhere where I lived, everybody has written a song, and it was just, you know, and they were not good, but I was there to record them. I would record my own stuff and bands I was playing in there. And one day this guy, I was going to a large church at the time, and that church had a big TV department, and they were making films and stuff. They just, you know, were into that. And so this guy called me and said, hey, are you busy in your studio? I need some help with cutting sound on this film. And I said, I don't know anything about it. I've never even worked on a computer. Everything I was doing in my studio was just like, you know, it wasn't on computers. And so I went in to help him out. I had a little bit of a lull. And he showed me Pro Tools for the first time. And he, it was like Pro Tools 2 or 1 point something. I forget what it was, but it was really early. And he said, okay, here's, it was a Western and it was a gunfight. And he said, here's this guy's gun. Here's the sound. And here's this guy and here's his gun sound and all the, you know, he showed me. And so the next couple of nights, he would go away and I would just kind of tinker and figure out, okay, that looks out of sync. Okay. I can nudge that. Okay, cool. And just learning the most basics of sound editing. And so I edited sound effects to this gunfight and immediately fell in love. And I went home and I said, that's what I want to do. I told my wife and she's like, well, how are you going to get into that? And I said, I don't know, but I want to learn about it. I want to do it. And because there was just, you know, I'd worked with sound my whole life at that point. I've never known what power it was to put sound to picture. It was just like, oh, it just amplified everything for me. And the storytelling side of it and everything. It was just so exciting. So from that point, I just started finding ways to let people know, I want to do sound work. I want to do this. I want to do that. And finally got a job at this production house in town. And they were doing a lot of original content. And I'm just like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm so like, I had imposter syndrome and I thought, well, I'm just gonna, you know, get online and read all day, every day about, you know, that at the time, DigiDesign, before they were bought by Avid, they had a forum and I learned so much on that forum. I went to school again on that thing and learned how to run Pro Tools, run AudioVision at the time was Avid's sound software at the time. I just started doing things like that and just kind of building up this knowledge base and getting good at it. And not just how to run the programs, but like theories and how to understand, you know, how to cut backgrounds and why they matter and how to layer sounds and how to do, you know, all the things like that. After about a year there or two, this guy was coming to town. This was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, by the way. This guy was coming from LA to help us work on an animated project that it was our first time to try anything animated. And I froze up. I knew that I was done for because everybody from LA obviously knows everything about everything. I just, you know, in my head, this is how I thought. So it's ludicrous, but I just figured this guy is coming from LA. He's going to see right through me. He's going to know I don't know what I'm doing. And so I had this vision in my head of him walking into my office, closing the door behind him and saying, you should think about selling insurance. And it's a true story.
Welcome to the inside of every creative person's mind ever.
Yes. Right. Anyway, he had been there 2 weeks now and I saw him walking toward my audio suite and he walks in and he closed the door behind him. And I said, it's happening. And he said, you should think about moving to LA. And I'm like, why? What are you talking about?
Why would I sell insurance in Los Angeles?
Right. So he said, no, you need to move to LA. You can hang with those guys.
Wow.
And I'm like, and that's when the floodgates opened. And I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm learning on the fly. I'm reading about it one day and doing it the next. And he said, that doesn't matter. Nobody knows what they're doing. We all figure it out on the fly because everything changes. The technology is so liquid. We all have to refigure it out every time anyway. And he took a lot of pressure off of me with that. And he said, you've got talent. You should be out there. And I said, no way. I don't want to live in LA. And he worked on me for 9 months. He was in town for 9 months. And he just constantly, I'll see you out there. I'll see you out there. Basically, he goes home. He says, I'll see you when you get out here. A couple of months later, the production company I was working for said, we need to take you part time. You know, we don't have enough work and you can use all the gear for free. But, we can't afford to pay you full time anymore. I said, well, What if I buy the gear and I take it to LA with me and I do whatever you need from out there? And initially said no, but they eventually said yes to that. So just a matter of months, I was moving my family. At the time I had three kids, wife and three kids, and going out and setting up shop in Valencia, and taking the equipment with me was a good stroke, because I was able to just do all these side gigs and freelance. And it just, I started working with everybody I could find out there. And I moved across the street from a friend of mine. Well, he wasn't a friend until we moved there, but he worked at Warner Brothers Animation, and he, came over and saw my studio, and he goes, "Oh, you're legit. Do you have a reel? I'll take it in for you." And so he did. And I started calling Warner Brothers Animation all the time and just trying to work my way in there. They finally called me and said, "We need you for 6 weeks. Are you available for 6 weeks?" I said, "Yeah, I just came off a show. I'm good." And 2 weeks into that, the guy comes into my office, closes the door, and he says, "Can you stay? We're going to have more for you." I'm like, yeah, I can stay. During that time, I'm trying to not over tell the story, but you know, basically during the time at Warner Brothers Animation, I was doing Saturday morning lineup stuff like dialogue and ADR conforms. And I was also tasked with restoring Looney Tunes, all of the shorts, the old Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes shorts.
Oh my God, what a dream job. I'm aging myself. But God, that would have been so cool.
That was amazing. I knew it was going to be cool, but I had no idea when I got into it what an honor it was going to be to do that work. I was using, at the time, 70, 75-year-old elements, some of them nitrate that only two places in LA were allowed to open because they're so volatile. And trying to create the best soundtracks for these, they were going to be uncut, unedited restoration of all these Looney Tunes, and we had a guy working on the picture side of it. So I was the audio guy, and we didn't change anything, we didn't add anything. Every once in a while, I had to create a new M&E track, music and effects track for some of the shorts, but in general, everything was there. And Treg Brown, the original editor, he quickly became a hero of mine because of what he had accomplished on all those Looney Tunes. Working with Carl Stalling and Milt Franklin, that orchestrator and composer of all the shorts, those three guys, what they did was nothing short of phenomenal. And if you go back and listen to any of those shorts, you'll see that Treg, for sound effects, he didn't cover everything. He just like would hit the highlights. And like we do now, we cover every single thing. The pin goes down to the desk. You know, we have to cover that on our soundtrack. He only did what was necessary, and it was beautiful and it worked, you know. And so that was, to this day, one of the coolest gigs I've ever had. And I did a little over 300 shorts for them.
Wow. Well, just for anybody that's listening that's of the younger generation, maybe they've heard of Looney Tunes, but they haven't experienced it. Some of the best unbridled creativity in the world of animation ever. And Everybody has their favorites. I'm just going to put this one out there. You want to really get a taste of the genius of this? I've got three words for you. Rabbit of Seville. Enough said.
Yes.
Best cartoon ever made.
It is the perfect Looney Tune. It is the perfect Looney Tune. It's genius, top to bottom. And if you didn't mention that one, that was the one I was going to bring up.
I mean, that's the one. Like to me, like it. Yeah. I can't imagine that anybody can dispute that there's anything out there that's better. There's so many other great Looney Tunes cartoons, but this one, It's just like you watch it and you're like, this is mesmerizing, and it's genius, and every frame of it works, and it's hilarious too.
Do you know, Zach, why they hold up? It's because they weren't made for kids. They were made for adults. These Looney Tunes, they were meant to be shorts before the features that the people would go see in the theaters. And they would show one or two of them. And they were meant to entertain adults. And I think they kind of started, you know, in the 70s and 80s, started dumbing them down to younger generations. But it's amazing to me that if anybody, we raised our kids on these things. We were like, okay, we were sure to do, you know, okay, you're going to watch this. You know, we had all the, you know, you're going to watch Andy Griffith. You're going to watch Dick Van Dyke. You're going to watch I Love Lucy. You know, we were
eat
like,
eat your broccoli and watch your Bugs Bunny.
Totally. And now my kids who are in their 20s, they totally appreciate that upbringing. They know that they were steeped in great pop culture of that day. But anyway, while I was at Warner Brothers Animation, a good friend of mine started working. His production company started making Hoodwinked, and they had known me from doing small things with them before, and so they asked me to sound design that, and so I joined in and I did all of it. I did everything at first because it was like I was the sound guy, you know, for the first couple of years, you know, and eventually they took it to Skywalker Sound to finish it. And they said, we've got space for you in the budget to go there and do this with them. And at that time, I was a little bit, I don't know, I was a lot intimidated by that thought because, you know, we got Randy Tom there, we got Tom Myers there, we got Gary Summers there, we've got, you know, all these heavyweights, and what's that going to be like? So I said yes, and I was very thankful for it. And I went up there and I had a conversation on my first day at Skywalker. And this is really important because it furthered the point I was making a minute ago about not having to know everything. I went in there knowing I am so young in my sound career here that I don't belong here. You know, I was just convinced myself. Mm. And though I knew I was good at what I did, I still am like, next to these guys, this, you know, it's a different level. And I was walking around with Tom Myers, who has an incredible career. I mean, he's just look him up. And he was showing me this is this, that is that, and around the tech building on the ranch. And I asked him a question about how we were going to do something. I forget what it was. Question wasn't important, but he said, oh, I have no idea. I'll get Bear, who was our Chris Barrick, our sound assistant, who was phenomenal. He said, I'll get Bear to look at that and let us know. And I was like, oh, okay, that's awesome. I'm glad that someone will know what to do. And he goes, look, let me stop. I know what you're thinking. We you can't know everything. You can't know how to do everything. You have to rely on a team. That's the only way we get stuff done. So if you don't know something, come to me, go to him, go to, you know, I mean, it was just like basically free license to not know everything. And again, that was a moment where I really needed that reminder, and it took a lot of weight off my shoulders. And so my time at Skywalker was very fruitful, very positive. And I'm so thankful for it because I got to meet these sound giants, Christopher Boyce and Ben Burtt, all these guys, and they were as humble as you can imagine. Just, you know, so kind. The reason I made sure to bring up Skywalker is because this is what eventually got me into picture editing. I became friends with Ben Burtt on the volleyball court. there is a place on the ranch called The Fit, and there's a volleyball court there. And at that time, everybody was playing volleyball during lunch. It was great. And so we're in there, you know, doing this for an hour, and then everybody runs back to their film. And one day after, he and I are talking, and I said, well, what are you working on right now? And he said, well, I'm doing episode 3. And I said, oh, so you're sound designing that? And he said, well, I'm cutting picture on that too. And I was like, I mean, poof, you know, because I knew that what an incredibly, you know, intensive job sound designing for a Star Wars film would be. But to also be cutting picture, And I said, how in the world are you doing that? He said, well, I have really good teams on both sides. So it's a lot of supervision, but I wanted to do it. And George was cool with it.
Wow. And
yeah. Right. And so that was another, you know, gate opening for my brain, kind of like when my dad said, you need to know more than one instrument. Ben wasn't telling me I needed to do this, but he was giving me this insight of there's a guy out there. And it, of course, Walter March too, right? And, you know, the pioneers, these guys they're not satisfied with just doing this one thing that they came into the business doing. They wanted to become filmmakers. They wanted to experience the process of cutting the film as well. And so Ben was like, yeah, I just love the I can shape the film as well as make it sound great. And that had been up to that point had been one of my beefs with sound was that, you know, it's usually locked when it comes to you and you have, you know, they say here, make it sound great. And you're like, okay, awesome. And then you're working on it. And you're like, really need this to open up here, or that shot right there is just not work. You know, these things in my head, that ship has sailed, you know, you can't do anything about it. And so when Ben told me he was doing that, it made me think maybe eventually I'll do some of that. And so I got Final Cut and started playing with it and never anything professionally, but I just started, you know, cutting little things for the family and personal stuff. Comes to 2008, everybody's starting to, you know, the economy crashes, right? And film industry's having a really hard time as well. And so my time at Warner Brothers Animation comes to an end. And nobody's buying a job. There's just nothing out there. My producer, Subi Montgomery, on Hoodwinked, she called me out of the blue. This is like a few months after being out of work and everybody's like, whoa, what do I do? She said, almost immediately, she said, hello, hey, you can cut picture, right? I'm like, yes, absolutely. Knowing that I barely knew what to do. And she goes, great, I have a TV show for you. And I just knew, okay, this is catching up too quickly to me. Subi, you know, I've never done this professionally, just kind of dabbled. She said, you're smart, you'll get it. And she took a massive risk on me and hired me to go to the Jim Henson Company and be the editor on Dinosaur Train.
My goodness, from like working with Skywalker, now with Jim Henson, like, my goodness, what a storied career.
It was, looking back, it feels like that. Like, at the time, it was just like, thank God, something that's, you know.
A gig, you know, work.
Yeah, anything. And so I went there and knowing, at least in my, I thought I knew that I'm going to go back to sound, but this is a good, you know, fix it for now. This is a good Band-Aid. Well, this guy, Subi came into my office about a month in and she said, you're going to need help. We have too many episodes coming in. We need to get a couple more editors. And so she said, I know a guy who I know you're really good friends with and you should call him. And so I called him and he had just left Disney feature. And so his name is Dan Molina, one of my best friends in the world. I called him and I said, hey, Dan, I'm working at Jim Henson. Oh, really? Yeah. And we need another guy. Would you like to come here and make about half what you were making at Disney? I literally said that to him and he goes, yeah, I would. and I couldn't believe it. I said, why do you want to do that? And he said, well, it's a bucket list thing for me. I've always wanted to work for Jim Henson. And so he came and we worked great together. And so we did that about a year. And when he left Jim Henson, I had just left. I was back at Warner Brothers for a minute. He called me and said, hey, I've got a feature. Would you like to come and be my associate editor on it? And so that's, I mean, I really thought I'm back in sound now. I'm just going to do that. But when he called me, I was like, maybe there's a future here. And so we did that feature. And then we went to Disney together for about 7 years. And fast forwarding a little bit, I right after Disney, I went to Netflix and did a show called Over the Moon, an associate on that for one of my heroes, a lot of people's hero, Glenn Keane, who is legendary animator. Lead animator on Aladdin, The Beast, Ariel, and all these, you know, iconic things that he helped create and do. So, and I knew him a little bit from my church. He actually went to my church. And so that was an experience I'll never forget. But I bring him up because about 10 years before this, I told him, I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know, you know, what I'm going to do. It was just like the 2008 thing. I'm just like, what am I supposed to go to? How am I going to get through this? And plus, I also feel like a fraud. I didn't go to school for this. Everybody I work with studied this, and I, you know, I'm just faking it. So that obviously this is a theme for me, right? This is.
I was just going to say, I'm hearing a recurring theme in today's conversation. I'm glad you pulled it out for me.
And he really bottled it up though, because what happened was he said, we're going to go to breakfast and we'll talk about it. And he gave me a book. It's called Art and Fear. And it talks about artists. It's basically stemmed from a group of artists that were all from different disciplines, and they all over a certain amount of time, they realized that they all shared the same fear, is that everybody's going to see through them, that they don't belong on their particular level. They don't, you know, they're frauds in some way. And he said they all realized that they could relate in this one way. And so they wrote this book to communicate that is part of being an artist. That is the fear from that is partly what compels more creation, which is another profound thought. And so when I got that book, he was just like, yeah, you got to read this. I dealt with the same thing for someone like him too. I dealt with the same thing, and I've given so many of these books out to people. And that really, really was the convincer for me, that was just, it's, you're not alone when you think, I don't belong here. I can't do. I mean, there's a difference between not being able to do the gig, but fearing the exposure to others and you know, all that. That's when you lose, because you need to realize that if you have this talent, if you have these skills, you know, believe in that. I don't think that anything's an accident. I think that, like, I'm a big believer in God, and I think that he gives us different skills for a reason and takes us through different trials for a reason. And I'm a product of everything I've experienced up to this point. And that's what makes me and you and all that, you know, it's pretty cliche, but that's true. And so anyway, that kind of brings us up to date to, you know, right after working on Glenn's film, I got the Garfield movie. I worked with Mark Dindal, who is, if you don't know who he is, he directed The Emperor's New Groove. He did Cats Don't Dance and Chicken Little. He's a fantastic filmmaker, even better guy, and maybe the most collaborative person I've ever worked with. He will sit and listen to all of your ideas. And if he likes it, it's in. Because he knows at the end of the day, his name is still going to say directed by, you know, and you're just making the movie better. And plus he knows that that gives, you know, if I bring an idea, he likes it and says, yes, let's do that. He knows that gives me a little ownership. You know, I feel like I've got a little, you know, that's a bit of me in there. And so he sees the power in that. So Garfield was a 5-year movie, and we finished it in March of 24. It came out in May of 24. And so that almost brings us up to date. And after that, I worked on a feature for about 8 months as an additional editor. And when my time was up there, that's when I went to Trader Joe's.
So sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to share a little bit more about my upcoming 5-day virtual summit that's all about navigating the future of entertainment. If you're enjoying today's conversation so far, and if you enjoy the show in general, you'll absolutely love this 5-day summit, because these are some of the most engaging conversations with some of the most jaw-dropping insights that I have seen in my 10 years of podcasting. When it comes to navigating our future as creatives, as artists, as creators, and as storytellers, I don't pretend to have all the answers, or any of them for that matter. But I do promise that I'm working harder than just about anybody else to help us find them. The short list of my amazing guests includes multiple Oscar winner Walter Murch, talking all about the future of storytelling with AI, content entrepreneur of the year Jay Klaus, helping us understand how creatives can maintain their value in the creator economy, world champion poker player and best-selling author Annie Duke, who talks all about how to make the difficult decision to either stick with your current career path or pivot, and writers and showrunners and the hosts of the hugely popular podcast, Happier in Hollywood, Liz Craft and Sarah Fain, who talk all about the landscape for people who are trying to pitch and sell their shows right now, not to mention what it takes to balance a career as both a creative and a creator. And this is the short list. To learn more and get your free ticket before we launch June 23rd, and yes, as a reminder, this is free, visit zacharnold.com/summit2025, zacharnold.com/SUMMIT2025. And now back to today's conversation.
Wow. Well, first of all, I can see why so many people want to give you a shot, because dear Lord, have you made me look good and made my job easy so far today. Number two, if you're looking for another path that you may end up going in the future that might bring you back to where you started, you very clearly have a future in teaching, because you're really good at not just telling your story, but pulling the insight from it that somebody can say, oh, I can see the value in this for myself. I've conducted many hundreds of these conversations over the years. And there's a difference between somebody just kind of goes on and on. Well, this happened, then I met this person, then I got this job, then I got this one. You're really good at constructing the story around it and the takeaways and how it can be valuable universally for people like you. So I'm just going to plant that seed where others have maybe said, I see something in you and you're thinking, I could never be a teacher. I'm a fraud. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to teach. I'm now seeing what maybe some of these people saw in you in the past, because I think you have an excellent way of storytelling and really kind of bringing it back to a point, which again, makes my job really, really easy, because I just sit here and I just get to nod for 45 minutes. But here's the part that I want to go into next, where I see a recurring theme. And I think this recurring theme is so important for where most people are now. I don't want to say everyone, but it's almost everyone. So many people are saying, what do I do next? Right? It's that for years, I think ever since the pandemic, we've been forced to hit the pause button and ask, is this really what I want to do with my life? Do I want to continue doing this work? Do I want to find something else? And we were voluntarily asking, do I want to stick with this thing or do I want to quit and move on? Now we've been forced into a position where for so many people, their career paths have quit on them. But one of the recurring themes that I see with so many people, especially the students in my academy when we workshop this, is this cognitive bias that's called the sunk cost fallacy, which is, well, I've already invested all of this time in this thing, and I feel like if I quit on this, even if I am interested in going this other direction, I'm a quitter and I've wasted all of those years. So I actually want to go back to the beginning, even though this is a recurring theme. The pivot point that I think is so pivotal is when you had the opportunity to get into sound. How is it that you didn't say to yourself, yeah, but I've gotten the degree in music and I want to be a drummer, and now I've learned all these instruments and I've gone down this path, and you're like, sound design's awesome. Let's do it. So how did you not get frozen in fear of, yeah, but look at what I've already invested and I'm going to be a quitter?
Well, I guess because they were so closely related for me, at least in my head, they were. I know that there are two different worlds, and the nomenclature in those different businesses is so different. But I think I just saw it as an extension of I saw it as going a step here instead of here or here. You know, I don't really have a great explanation for it other than I felt something in my heart. There's been a few times, and maybe you've had the same thing. There's been a few times in my life where somebody will say, we need X, or here's an opening there, or something like that. And your heart leaps. And I've learned to pay attention to it. And that's kind of what happened when, I mean, it was like a 2 or 3 day leap, you know. It was like, what the hell is all this stuff? What, okay, computer. Okay, now I have to figure out how to work on a computer. Now Pro Tools. Okay, that's cool. But I mean, it doesn't, you know, I'm working on ADATs. That's the future in this music studio. So it was just, when I saw this happen, I think I was just like, this is just too cool to ignore. I didn't, that's my explanation. That's why mm-hmm. I didn't shy away from it. I think it was just so, the lure was so strong to me.
Sure. So what I don't want to do is certainly answer the question for you or put words or thoughts into your mouth, but tell me if I'm on the right track. Something that we talk a lot about in our community, that I talk about with my students, that I talk about on the podcast, is how the way that we've been trained to specialize widgets to do one thing, right? We, as early as preschool, what do you want to be when you grow up? Then you choose a major. Then you train for that skill. Then you start at the bottom and you work your way up. The system never worked, but now the curtain has been pulled back and we're like, wow, this whole system is bullshit and it's all falling apart and we're all trying to figure out how to redesign our careers from the ground up. But I think what's interesting and different about you, and again, you tell me if I'm on the wrong track here, it doesn't sound like you ever defined yourself by your job. It wasn't, well, I'm a music teacher, or I'm a drummer, or I'm a sound editor, or I'm a picture editor. It goes mm-hmm. back to kind of this other thread that I wanted to pull on, which is in everything that I've seen of yours, from a 15-year-old blog to the work that you've done recently, it seems to me your identity is that I'm a creative. I'm a creative person and I want to express myself creatively. And these were just different avenues versus, well, I don't want to throw away my identity as a music teacher or a drummer and now I'm a sound editor. It's cool. Another way to creatively express myself. Am I somewhat on the right track here?
No, that's 100% it. And I mean, I'll just add to it. You're right on track. What I'll add is that it just felt like, they were so applicable to each other. They were, they just felt so adjacent to me. And maybe, I mean, even looking back, it still feels that way. But I guess if you're at the starting line and you're thinking, I'm going to be a musician or I'm going to be a sound editor or whatever, I mean, you have two different worlds and all that. But I was never going to give up being a musician. I guess that maybe that was part of my saving grace in that moment, because I was like, I was never going to stop being a drummer. I'm still playing. So that part of my life was still here. I'm just adding this new thing, I guess. And so when I had people, and maybe you had the same thing when you'll, like, if you're interviewing for a job and they're like, well, we're working on this platform, is that a problem? And I'm like, well, no, I'm an editor. I can edit. And it doesn't matter what I prefer Avid. Okay. That's my tool of choice, but I've been working on a show the last couple of months, House of David, and that's Premiere Pro. And that is not my first choice. It's good. It's very good at what it does, but so those skills, I guess I feel like whatever skill set you bring to a table, and if you're adding a new one, well, I do that too. Now this skill set gets a little bigger. Now I can do this too. So now I can do these three things. And, you know, and I don't know, maybe in the back of my head, I was like, now I'm good. I can, I can go play on the street corner. I can, I can cut sound. I can, you know, whatever. And so that's kind of my answer to that.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back to what I think is probably the piece of advice that strung all this together. Going back to your dad, you got to learn more than one instrument. And this, to me, this feeds into the feeling of being a fraud, the imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. I've seen this so much from people over the last couple of years when they're trying to find other paths to either change their career path altogether or just find income in other areas. It's this mentality of I'm starting over. And I just keep trying to remind them, you have so many different skills, life experiences, work experience. All of these things are transferable if you learn how to kind of thread that needle. And as you alluded to, I want to go a little bit deeper into this, where if somebody says, hey, do you know Premiere? And you're like, well, I'm an editor and I can learn the tools. Where that's great is if you know that in the first week or two, you're the kind of person that can figure it out, they can solve problems, that knows enough to not get fired. There's also a world where they say, well, you're coming in to do a cleanup edit. We've got a ton of notes and we need you to deliver by Friday. Now you're going to get fired because you're incompetent. And right. I think that so many people conflate those two where they think on day one, I have to know everything. I always tell my students, you need to know enough to not get fired the first week. And if you're the kind of person that can ask good questions and has enough humility to say, hey, I don't know how to do this. Can you show me how to do it? Then by and large, you're not only going to survive, but you can thrive. But we just assume, nope, I got to know all of it. Reminds me of a, not to make this podcast an interview about me as well, but it reminded me of a story I don't think I've ever told on the podcast before, which is that when I had basically talked myself into having no business whatsoever getting hired to edit the TV show Burn Notice, I had no experience in television, no credits, and I wasn't even an assistant editor. And I remember the post-producer having a meeting with me because they were kind of nervous, like, who is this kid? Why did the showrunner hire this person? And one of his questions, very basic, hey, how do you feel about Avid? No problem. Bring it on. I'd worked on Final Cut Pro 7 for 10 years. I'd used Avid in college. But here's what I knew. For this opportunity, I was going to fucking figure it out. And I was going to figure it out fast. And I'll never forget my first week on the job. I had an assistant editor that had been assigned to me that I think was pretty convinced he should have been in the editor's chair and he deserved it. And I'll never forget the look on his face. My first week, he's thinking, who is this kid? Why are you cutting the show? I said, can you show me how to make an audio keyframe in Avid? And the look on his face. But I knew how to cut story. I knew how to tell their story. It was ridiculously late nights and both weekends just because I was figuring out, like, oh, I can do this in Final Cut. How do I do it in Avid? Where is this stupid button? Right? Yeah. But then I delivered my editor's cut and everybody shut up. But it took me months to get comfortable with Avid again. But I knew in myself when he said, are you good with Avid? I wasn't good with Avid. I was good with being able to figure it out in the amount of time for which I wouldn't have been fired.
That's a great story. And we should have a moment of silence for Final Cut 7.
NLE ever. Am I wrong?
It was unmatched. And I'm partial because that was what I learned on. And I got really good on Final Cut 7. And luckily, when I got called for Dinosaur Train at Jim Henson Company, that was on Final Cut 7. When I my first feature, when Dan called me to go to this first feature, that was on Final Cut 7. So I was like in my comfort zone all the way through there. And then when we went to Disney, that's an Avid house. And so it's like, okay, I knew that day was coming. I knew that I was going to have to, you know, the reckoning was coming of you're going to have to switch over to Avid. And it was so not intuitive compared to Final Cut 7. That it took me a couple of years to get comfortable, you know, I got there, but it just was, it's very painful. But now it's like, that's my, NLE of choice, you know, I want to stay there.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel very, very similarly. What I'm curious about now, and this is not to get doom and gloom about the state of the industry, but I always like to be real about the industry. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that if we were to go back to late 2024, that if anybody should have been poised to be able to find more creative work somewhere in the industry where they had enough skills to get hired, like you're a generalist, you're the generalist of generalists in your world where you had so many different and varied skills. Did you really reach a point where you said there's literally nothing left but Trader Joe's?
Yes. And that's why I went there. I had a 90% chance of getting on a show at not a show, a feature at Netflix in early January. And so I'd been at Trader Joe's for about a month. And then the fires happened. And then they decided, we're going to pull back. We're going to let everybody heal. We're going to, you know, we're not going to add anybody new. We're just going to extend our schedule a little bit and let everybody kind of cope with this disaster, which I can't get mad at those reasons. You know, that would be really crappy of me to do that. So I was disappointed. I was frustrated. But other than that opportunity that came that close, I've been doing a lot of little development gigs and this and that, you know, and then there was just literally nothing there. And finally I just got to the point, was like, I know I'm going to go to Trader Joe's and I'm going to make, you know, X amount an hour. It just was very, very low. But I said, at least it'll be something. It's going to be more than what unemployment will bring in. And, you know, so it had been a hard year. And I kind of had the same thought, you know, that you just expressed. I really thought, and I started looking 6 months before Garfield was finished. I was getting feelers out, you know, I'm going to be, but, you know, the strikes and then the near strikes and then, you know, just everything, there was no air in the room for new things. You know, I mean, I remember my first few years of Garfield, there weren't enough editors in the world. they're projects and projects and projects, looking for people and assistants and all these different things. And it just kind of flipped. And I knew that I was going to have to do it. So, but there's so many reasons now that I'm thankful I did. And it's beyond the, you know, little bit of financial help it gave me at the time. But I feel like, okay, I've been, for, you know, better or worse, I've been sitting in a chair editing sounds and picture for a long time now. And I've been, and, you know, I'm not a stranger to hard work out there. I mean, I mowed lawns in college, you know, there's, I get it. But it was such a nice refresher for me to go get my ass kicked at Trader Joe's and feel that good tired that we talked about, and remind myself that there's other people out there that are also going through what I have gone through. Maybe they went through it a couple of years ago, and that's why they're here. And good people, smart people, brilliant people. And they're, I'm not going to name any names, but there's one person at the store that used to be a physical therapist. And they told me that they like this better. It's just, maybe it's the community, maybe it's a lot of things, but it just, a lot of people have left other careers to be there. And I'm not quite to that point yet where I want to do that. I need to create some more, like we talked about, but I could see myself like retiring and from the film industry eventually and going back to Trader Joe's and going, hey, let me back in. Cause it's been great.
Right. Well, you are definitely correct in that. You're certainly not the only one that is either at this threshold, has already crossed this threshold, is considering crossing this and knowing that maybe they're out of options or close to out of options.
Yeah, the post that you've been referring to on LinkedIn, that I would say, I can't remember how many comments it's.
It's many, many, many hundreds. Actually, while you're talking, I'm actually going to look it up.
But a lot of them.
It's a lot.
A lot of these people are telling me exactly this story. They're saying, yeah, me too. I was a production designer for 20 years and now I'm working at Target, or, you know, I mean, just different things that everybody is coming to me with their stories because they know I get it now. And I literally thought, I'm going to do this post. Let's go back to the moment of when I actually pushed post. Because I was, up to that moment, I'd been terrified that that producers and other, you know, directors and filmmakers that I've worked with before and ones that I do want to work with would find out that now I'm here. Oh, well, he's not serious anymore. He's not really part of the industry. And that's just was what I was thinking they would think. And I just got to a point where, you know, I'm tired of hiding this, and I'm going to be the one that tells this story. I don't want anybody showing up on Facebook and saying, I saw Mark Kiefer working at Trader Joe's. I just needed to do it. Plus I felt at the time, I'd been there probably 3 or 4 months. I thought, I'm proud of what this work is now. I understand what I'm learning here about myself and about these people. And so I'm like, okay, that's my story to tell. And so when I did that, I thought it'll be like a typical LinkedIn post of mine that gets 100 people engaged. You know, a few comments, a lot of my editor friends that are like, yeah, me too. And then it goes away. And then, I mean, I haven't looked at the analytics for a while, but it seems like, I think it had like almost 500,000 impressions.
Well, I can tell you at least the front facing analytics, currently 17,153 likes, including 3,128 hearts for those of you that are counting, and over 1,500 comments. And I am the last person who gives a shit about vanity metrics on social media. But what this says is that your post resonated with so many people, and also that LinkedIn is really good at understanding who you're connected to. Because as soon as I clicked on it, all of the likes were people that I already knew, half of which I've worked with. So that comes back to you and I know so many of the same people. But you're already kind of tapping into what I wanted to hit this point home, because I know a lot of people, the thought in their mind is, yeah, but if I do this, if I have to make this decision, this is embarrassing. People are going to think that I'm less than, or, oh, they've quit, they've given up. And that's really why, you know, more than 6 months later, people like me are still coming out of the woodwork saying this story is so important. Because you even said in your post, there is no shame in supporting your family. There's no shame in taking a job like this, or being a security guard, or delivering Uber Eats, or teaching an accounting class at a local middle school, right? This is what it takes for all of us to get through this.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. You said it.
So I guess the last place that I would want to go is just talking a little bit more and helping those that are kind of going through this process of making this decision. You even said, and this I didn't realize when I reached out to you, you're still working at Trader Joe's 1 or 2 days a week. So how are you kind of managing going back and forth between, it sounds like you're kind of sort of back into work mode, whether it's picture editing, sound editing, but you're still kind of one foot in that world. How are you managing all this?
It's out of desire to stay at the store, but to be completely honest with you. In early April, I got a call from the show House of David. It's a new Amazon Prime series. And they released their first season in February. I think it was late February. And it hit number one. It was a hit immediately. And so Amazon said, yes, give us season two. And so they've been working on that ever since. And I got a call to come edit one of the episodes. And I thought, well, okay, that's a couple of months of work there. And I wanted to keep my relationship with the store in good standing. So I said, okay, guys. And they were very flexible with me. I just told them I need to, you know, Monday through Fridays are going to be for the show now. And they knew. I mean, I came into my interview telling them what I do, and I'm going to keep looking for this kind of work. And miraculously, they still hired me. I don't know why they did, but other than they thought I could, you know, do the work. But it just, I'm so thankful that they've been very supportive. And I've seen this with other people, not just me, of supporting their creative ventures. And so I started on that. I just started doing like 1 day a week, 2 days on the weekends, you know. And I don't even know if the show knows that I work at Trader Joe's. I've never talked about it with them. So
I bet they know if they have LinkedIn profiles.
Maybe. Yeah.
What I love about it, though, is that when you address the elephant in the room, nobody cares about the elephant in the room. But if all you're thinking is, don't ask about the elephant, don't ask about the elephant, then it just consumes you. And you're like, fuck it. I'm just going to put it out there and look at the community that it created.
Yeah. You're no good to anybody. You're not creative at that point. You're hindering whatever you're a part of at that moment. It'll jack up your whole life unless you let the truth out.
Well, I wanted to start to wrap up the conversation by first saying that, again, there are so many other areas that we could talk, and I feel like it mesmerizes me that you and I did not know each other before, because I just feel like my guess is at some point we literally have bumped into each other, whether it's at a gala or a mixer or whatever it is, because we have... Literally, I just looked at the likes on your post. I'm like, worked with them, know them. So it's ridiculous. But I really do admire the fact that you've put this out into the world, because I feel like between those comments, now between this conversation, I hope that it gives people the sense that it is okay to take these opportunities. It is okay to deviate, knowing that maybe this is actually part of the path and not a deviation of the path or quitting on the path. It's just a necessary part of survival. So I just, I first wanted to frame this once again to thank you for being so honest and vulnerable about it. So the place that I'd like to end the conversation is, we have a lot of people that listen to the show that are mid-career. I get some people that are a little bit earlier in their careers, but one of the most common themes is more about navigating midlife, having already been successful in something, but now realizing there's more to life than just the credits, than just the prestige, than just the money. So for those that are mid-career, that most likely have less generalized skills than you do, or less credits or less accolades or less awards, how would you be navigating the situation right now? If you were not in the position where you had all of these different various skills, if you were only a sound editor, only a picture editor, only a musician, where would you go next, given the present climate that we're all in right now?
I mean, that's the $1 million question. I don't know that I can answer that.
Well, I think what's ironic is you've already answered it.
Oh.
I think, and here's what I loved about this conversation so much. As soon as you said it, I wrote it down. I highlighted it in green, which means this is a keeper. So I think that this is going to be one of those where I'm going to ask your permission to blatantly steal from you going forwards. It's the mentality of, you can't learn just one instrument. That to me is the solution out of this mess. If we continue to think, I am this thing, I have this one skill, this is my one marketable ability to support myself and get hired, that's a road to nowhere in this future.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I guess without really trying to do that, that's what I've done. And honestly, this might be, I've told my story a few times, but I've never, gone back as far as that instrument conversation with my dad. And that is, I can see now that you've pointed it out, that that is a real catalyst. That is a real kind of like beginning of the spring, right? That turns into the stream, that turns into the river for me. And so thanks, Dad.
well, it's for anybody that's a longtime listener, viewer, follower of the work that I do, they either know this already or it wouldn't come as a surprise. But my favorite film of all time is Inception. I'm always in everybody's stories trying to figure out, what is the point of Inception? That's really the questions underneath all the questions underneath all the questions.
Yeah.
And to me, I think the Inception point for you is that, just one small piece of advice. Don't just learn one instrument, because I think that's what's helped serve you to get where you are. And frankly, I think it's the advice all of us need to survive the future of all this chaos.
And I think I'll just add one little tiny bit to that, is that thank God I was willing to listen to my dad at that time instead of being proud of becoming a decent drummer for that age. I could have easily gone, no, I got to focus, you know, on this. And I don't know. I rolled with it, and I'm so happy in hindsight that I did. And so whatever your second, third, fourth instrument is going to be, anybody listening, just, you know, be willing to pick it up and start learning it.
Man, I could not have closed this any better had I tried. If I had orchestrated, no pun intended, if I had orchestrated today's conversation, could not have finished it at a better place than that. Mark, I'm really, really happy that the LinkedIn algorithm brought us together. I talk a lot of shit about algorithms and social media. But in this case, the algorithm has done some good in bringing us together. So glad that we connected. So appreciative of you sharing your story. If somebody listening is inspired, they're interested in connecting with you or learning more, where should we send them?
I'm kind of limited at the moment, but they can find me on LinkedIn and they can find me on Instagram, you know, the usual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Facebook.
We'll make sure to we'll link to all of the above in our show notes. So anybody, when they're done, they want to scroll with their thumbs down a little bit further. There we go. They have a way to connect with you directly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Great. Well, Mark, once again, this is a tremendous pleasure and cannot appreciate enough you taking the time to share your story.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for hanging out with us today. I hope that Mark's story reminded you that meaning and purpose are not always tied to a job title, a credit, an award, or even an industry. They're found in how we show up and approach our work, no matter what that work might be. If you too are struggling with the anxiety and potentially even with the grief that's associated with losing your job or even your identity, I highly recommend my most recent episode with best-selling author and grief counselor Christina Rasmussen. And if you're looking for the courage to summon strength in even your darkest moments, definitely check out my interview with Bevan Ferrand. Lastly, if this episode made you feel even just a little less alone, please let me know by leaving a quick rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. You never know, your words might be just the nudge that somebody else needs to keep going. And as always, thank you for letting me into your day, your earbuds, and your heart. Take care and be well. And oh yeah, one more thing. Don't forget to get your free tickets to my 5-day live virtual summit that's all about navigating the future of entertainment. You can learn more and register at zacharnold.com/summit2025.